Welcome to the film experience, the supporting actress SmackDown of 1943. I would like, and this is the companion podcast. You've already read the actual SmackDown, so I want to welcome my guest, Rebecca Powell. Am I saying your name right?
Polly, but nobody ever gets it right,
okay,
so that's
Rebecca
fine.
Polly. Very excited to have you.
Excited to be here.
And Crispin Lopez.
Thank you for thinking I was cool enough to invite.
And Yasin Ali.
Hello, esteemed panelists. Excited to be here as well.
And Kieran Scarlett.
Hi, I'm excited to be here as well. I wish it were under better movie circumstances.
Yeah.
Now, Kieran, you've done another panel before this, but you are the only returning panelist.
Mm-hmm.
So how did this... how did these movies rank against the last one you did?
I found these movies pretty interesting, actually, even though I didn't... I liked one of them, but... I liked two of them, actually, but I think that this lineup is better. It's also more movies, so it's kind of unfair to judge. There were only three movies last time.
When I announced 1943, a lot of people groaned, like, oh, the movies are so long. Rebecca, I see you nodding. Were these a trial to sit through?
Yeah, I'm not gonna lie. They were. It felt very. I mean, especially given the Best Picture winner of that year was Casablanca, which is such an amazing film. The rah-rah patriotism of some of these, given the time period, was explainable. It was a bit clunky, just a smidge, and. Some of the individual performances were good. I will say that.
Yeah, the performance. A lot of times with movies with long running times, as long as the performances are good, I can stick it out. So mm-hmm. I actually enjoyed So Proudly We Hail, and I suspect maybe that opinion is not shared. But I did anybody else like it?
I liked it.
I liked it.
I had problems with it though.
I liked Veronica Lake in it. She should have been nominated instead of Goddard. I know she was our winner, but I'm just gonna say that
she was a problem for me.
Know that I asked to be on this one because I liked 1943. I like old movies, so I was very excited to talk about this. And Veronica Lake is my girl. I've been researching her for the last like 4 years about her life, and I love her. So yeah, watching So Proudly We Hail. This is my second or third time, I think, watching it all the way through. And yeah, I gotta go with Rebecca. She's the one that I think deserved the nomination more. Although I'm fairly confident there was not a chance in hell they were gonna do it, because of the fact that Veronica was a bit of a pain in the ass. But, you know, I think she's great. I can see why they nominated Paulette. Again, I think that more than anything, like politics, went into that decision specifically.
Uh-huh.
So, is this for a larger project that you're researching Veronica Lake?
No, just for fun.
Okay.
I figure there haven't been any books written about her since 73. So, you know, it started as like a fun hobby, and people ask me, you know, oh, are you going to do a proper book? I'm like, I don't have the time or the resources or any of that. But, you know, if I can at least get some of the stuff like documented, maybe somebody who has time and money and all of that can do something with it, and I can just get a really cool shout out.
So you must remember this episode on her was great and fascinating.
It's problematic. Some of her facts were not correct.
Yeah.
But
and her character in this film, I can see. I mean, it's a great performance, but her arc is like she decides it's not a right thing to kill Japanese POWs, like, yay? That's a really low bar, Veronica.
Yeah.
But you fired it, I guess.
I love the role. I mean, it was a very different performance for her at the time, and that's where I'm a little surprised they didn't nominate it, because by that point she had done, like, noirs, and, you know, she'd been in Preston Sturges' Sullivan's Travels. You know, she was always great as a comedian and then just never got to do comedy. And so here, watching this and seeing, you know, some of her noir stuff, it's a totally different role. You know, she's sensitive. She's conflicted. She's a flawed heroine. And I think that, you know, it was nice to nominate Paulette because the character's brassy and positive and sexy. But I think Veronica's performance is more nuanced, especially to fans who had to have watched it in 43 and been like, oh my gosh, this is something totally different.
Mm-hmm. And that's why I personally didn't give Paulette, I think, as high an average as a lot. As you guys did. I didn't dislike the performance. I don't dislike her. We've seen the brassy sidekick a lot before, and it just didn't really stand out for me.
These are American women. They could be your neighbor's daughter. Yet, in the desperate hour of our country's need, they rose to magnificent heights of courage no woman and few men have ever reached before. From their heroic deeds, their boundless love, their women's hearts, comes this true story of intense dramatic power. So proudly we hail, starring Claudette Colbert, who found her love in battle and spent her honeymoon in a foxhole.
Everything that happens, everything I do, you're part of it. I can't get you out of my mind.
Don't try.
Paulette Goddard, who wore her black lace nightgown as an evening dress to keep up her morale. And the morale of Kansas, the fighting Marine with plenty of smooch. Played by Sonny Tufts. Veronica Lake, you'd never think a girl so beautiful could be so cold a killer.
I know what I'm doing. I know why I'm here. I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to kill Jeff. Every blood-stained one I can get my hands on.
When I said that Veronica Lake was a problem for me, it's not the... I thought the performance was good. It was the characterization of that character that I had a lot of... I just found it very confusing, and, like, what I think it was Kristen was saying about how she just sort of decides that she doesn't want to kill Japanese POWs after, like, really, really seeming like she was going to. And then the whole... the way that her character is dispatched of, no spoilers, but it just... it felt really... it felt... broad to me. Mm-hmm. It felt broad and also confusing, and I found it really hard to track at times. But I thought that the performance was definitely interesting, and I would say that I was surprised that it was not her that who was nominated, and not I was surprised it was her who wasn't nominated. Who was not? What am I saying? I'm surprised that she didn't get nominated instead of Godard.
Especially with that monologue where she breaks down, it's really upsetting. Yes. I wasn't prepared for it. I had to pause after because I was like, I didn't know that. You know, she was capable of this, and it's just, it kind of hits all of those marks that you think, like, an Oscar clip would, but I know they didn't show the clips back then, but yeah, it was surprising that she wasn't at least in conversation.
Yeah.
Like, of course, and there's a slap fight as well, which is very, like, that's an easy thing for people to latch on to. Yeah.
Like, my main experience for Veronica Lake is I Married a Witch, which is a delightful film, but it's like, damn, Veronica! You have range.
Did anybody else find it hilarious, though, that in the scene where Claudette realizes that that Veronica has become the night nurse to the POWs, and she panics and runs to her and realizes that she has had this change of heart and she's not gonna, as a nurse, murder sick people.
Woohoo!
A redemption. But it's hilarious to me that Claudette's like, oh no, she's okay, she figured it out.
Right.
I'm just going to leave her alone with him again.
Yeah.
What did we think of Claudette Colbert in it?
I like sassy Claudette Colbert, which was my problem with For Whom the Bell Tolls too. I like my Gary Cooper in rom-coms, and I like my Claudette Colbert in rom-coms, and I do not like seeing either of them be serious. That's just me.
I think I'm with you there.
Yeah, well, I was surprised, because I am actually a huge Claudette Colbert fan, but I had not seen this movie, and I just did not think... it's like she was sleepwalking through it or something.
Yeah, like you're sponge bathing George Reeves and you're not into it? Like, what is your problem?
Well, it probably didn't help. It didn't help me that this week I watched the war movie she did after this, which is Since You Went Away. And in watching that movie, I was just thinking, oh, it's So Proudly We Hail, only the nurses are her children. Mm-hmm. And so... I was sitting there thinking, so Claudette did not want to play a 40-year-old mom when she made Since You Went Away. And I was like, okay, but you kind of just played this character in the previous movie. So she kind of became like this emblem of the 1940s you know, maternal figure that, like, stiff upper lip. I don't get her normally. I mean, I like her in certain things, but I never really think she's fantastic. And here I was just like, it's Claudette. She's solid. She's dependable. She's loyal. You know, it's just all the tropes I expect from her.
Yeah. And I mean, I just go back to, like, her work with Lubitsch, and I just...
Right.
Or, like, Cleopatra. She had spunk.
Sign of the cross. Okay.
Oh, milk bath.
Yeah.
She's so regressive. Like, she so retreats to the background in this in terms of the performance. And I said this in my write-up, like, Paulette Goddard almost feels like a lead at some points because she's so much more alive and charismatic than Colbert is. And she has a lot of screen time. It feels like an ensemble, but, like, yeah, Colbert really feels like she's just kind of... She's just kind of there and just going through the motions. It didn't feel like a very anchoring lead performance to me.
Yeah, it was, like, I mean, admittedly, it would probably be hard to play catatonic as your main as your main character trait. But I actually liked the movie. I liked that it had such a weird range of tones, and I was, like, with it the whole time, even though... You know, rah-rah war movies aren't necessarily my favorite of genres. Mm-hmm. But I thought it was interesting throughout, which the same cannot be said of our other war picture, For Whom the Bell Tolls.
Ugh.
That was long.
That was not good.
Does anyone have any suspicion as to why that was the number one most popular movie of 1943?
I was going to say, like I think everyone was just so sad during World War II and so confused, and they didn't know what they were doing.
Ingrid Bergman didn't know what she was doing when she was filming that movie.
Why did she get nominated for that and not Casablanca? It's madness.
Why was she cast in that? Like, she's supposed to be a teenager? Like, I get that that's a typical problem, but it's a little bit beyond the pale in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I loved, like, I voted for Katina. I loved her in this movie because it's like, it woke me up when she was on screen. Gary Cooper's very, you know, he's very stoic. He's very, he can be so charismatic and so fun and like Bluebeard's Eighth Wife or Heaven Can Wait when he's paired with a good director. Mm-hmm. Here, he's just like, I'm so, I'm manly. And Katina brought the fire.
I think part of the reason that she didn't get nominated is because at the time they didn't think Casablanca was going to be a big deal. It was supposed to be like this mid-level movie with Bogart being the big lead at the time, and Bergman was untested, and so she really really wanted this role. And I think a lot of it is the name recognition. It's not just that it's Gary Cooper, who was a bigger star at that time, who's pretty much... I mean, we know now that it's the two leads that are huge, but I think at the time this was sold on Cooper's presence. And Hemingway. Hemingway was a huge deal in the 40s, even though he said that Hollywood butchered all of his work, and they never did it right. But, you know, For Whom the Bell Tolls is supposed to be, like, this anti-war novel, and it's presented as just this positive, like, white savior film. And yeah, watching it, I was just thinking, God, I can see now why Hemingway really didn't like Hollywood touching his stuff.
Yeah, and like what you're saying about the white saviorness of it all, like the way that every like native Spanish character had like a large layer of dirt on them as their makeup.
So much brown face in this movie.
And, like, so much brown face, and like,
yeah.
Katina Pax knew she's Greek, right?
Yeah.
Oh, it was just, there were so many things in this movie where I was just like, and what you were saying about Rebecca when you said that you voted for her because she sort of woke you up a bit while you were watching it.
Mm-hmm.
I felt the same way too, but she woke me up in like a Ruby Thews and Cold Mountain kind of way where I'm like, this is the function of this character, and that's the only function of this character inside of a very ponderous movie that otherwise doesn't really work. And I admire, like, that's a tough task for an actress to shoulder, and I think she's fine, but I didn't really get much from that character, honestly.
And she also stands out that much more because the other performances, there's no urgency to them, despite, like, the stakes being so high, like, mm-hmm.
They're all just sitting around on a mountain.
Super catty, which is fine, but when she enters the frame, it's just, okay, I realize what we're doing. There's a goal. And then when she's off screen, it's like, what am I watching? What's going on? Why is Bergman so I mean, there's a moment where Cooper, like, sorry, not Cooper, what's the male lead's name? Totally blanked.
No, that is Gary Cooper.
But, okay. When he, like, covers Bergman's mouth, like, he's like, stop talking, and she's just completely silent. So it was really refreshing to have, you know, Paxton now just kind of take up space and do a little bit of pantomime and, you know, be very stagey.
She can get her monologue on. That monologue of being ugly.
Oh, for Katina, yeah. Was anybody else surprised, though, at... I think sometimes we think of old movies as innocent when there's... It's just a lot of, like, context you need to place yourself in to realize that they're not that innocent. Because I was a little surprised that both of So Proudly We Hail and For Whom the Bell Tolls have discussions about rape, but they're not actually naming it.
Yeah, that's... It was weird, because I had never seen For Whom the Bell Tolls before, and I watched it, and yeah, when there's that discussion about it, I mean, if you're watching... I'd love to know what somebody watching it at the time would have thought, because it's fairly evident when you're watching it now that they're talking about rape, and, you know, for me, I think what most people like about classic cinema is the subtext, and, yeah, you know, having to look deeper into something. So I definitely think it was great in a movie that kind of skews the politics of the very overt political book that they're adapting. Mm-hmm. I did like that. I was like, okay, so their argument is we can't talk about politics, but we can include some other things that are happening, you know, during the war and during what's happening to women, which is rape. So I was like, okay, I get it. It doesn't make the movie any better, but I did like that it was pretty much, I mean, it's a pretty frank conversation for 1943.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that similar scene in So Proudly We Hail, where the cinematography is, like, so dark and shadowy in that scene, and it's actually really disturbing when the women are being attacked, and they're huddled in that one camp thing that's remaining, and the soldiers are firing, and they have that discussion about what happens to women in war zones, and it's actually a really disturbing scene, and I was just surprised by it.
It definitely has a little bit of The Searchers in it, too, which was the concept of, like, if we're going to be... It's not just the concept of, like, rape. It's being raped by a foreign other. And the whole idea of, like, well, if that's going to happen, then you should just kill me now. We should all just kill each other. Which, again, is very reminiscent if you've seen The Searchers. It's not enough to be kidnapped by Native Americans, but if you're raped by them, then we should just kill you because you're of no use to anybody.
Yeah. Raped and indoctrinated by them in the case of The Searchers.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
Yeah. But, like, yeah.
So what? Fear of rape combined with racism.
Yeah, can we talk about the racism in So Proudly We Hail for just a moment? Like, how they have the, like, am I crazy or does she say the monkey looks so much like them? Like, when they're in the woods with the pet monkey, where she's like, oh, like, and he looks so much like them. And I feel like she was talking about the, like, the people on the island. And, like, that to me felt really awful. And it sort of, like, put a sour note in a film that I was otherwise enjoying. Or am I imagining it? Am I the only one who caught that?
Now that you say that, I remember some sort of line like that, but I'll admit I did not clock that at all.
Yeah, they had, like, the monkey who they were putting glasses on. They're like, and it's funny because he looks so much like them.
Oh! Well, and it's not surprising. To bring it back to the next year when I watched Since You Went Away, they talk very cavalierly about the Japs, you know, that's their term. And so watching this, I was really surprised that, yeah, So Proudly We Hail, which is a very American story, is the one that, yeah, has the racist angle of, like, these are definitely the enemy. Whereas, again, not to unnecessarily piss on For Whom the Bell Tolls, but it is a point. That's a very political book where, you know, the politics, there was a very clear-cut enemy, but because Spain was our ally in a way, it was neutral during World War II, we didn't make a big effort to call them out for their politics. So yeah, watching this, I was like, of course it's the incredibly American film that has to have the racist angle.
And then, does anyone remember the scene where Claudette Colbert has this, like, speech about U.S. myopia, and she kind of call, like, it has this existential speech about what they're doing there, which is a really surprising moment. And then the next day, she's like, oh, I was just blowing off steam. I didn't mean it. You know, it's completely opposite.
But yeah, that happens when you're in these having discussions about maybe we shouldn't be here.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like, we're still in the thick of it. We don't need to be making people's minds muddled, I mean, guess.
The thing that's interesting about that in modern context is that's, you know, we're still doing that all the time in in these political discussions where people will go halfway to making some realization about maybe America isn't perfect, and then they'll pull back from it.
It's like, oh, now's not the time.
Right.
Yeah, it was interesting that, you know, watching these movies, the jingoism isn't nearly as heavy as I thought. I've definitely seen more movies from, like, earlier in the 40s that are far more, you know, America first type of movies than anything else. But it is, and it's very interesting that we're, like, halfway through the war. The war would end, what, 2 or 3 years later? So at this point, I think, if anything, there feels like a complacency with the movies that, like, we're in this, we've said everything already. And, you know, if you watch movies from, like, 41, 42, we've already said all that. Now we're just trying to deal with how to be in this morass that we've been in.
Yeah.
And Watch on the Rhine definitely has that element, too, where it's very, like, pat on the back about, you know, self-sacrifice and a reaction to the early isolationism of America, and then of Hollywood, too, by extension, because except for Warner Brothers, they came on board pretty late with supporting the American war effort, and now it's very much like in Watch on the Rhine, look at how great we are. Look at how great this husband character is. He's willing to abandon his family for the sake of la la la.
To the point where, like, Betty Davis has that. I started laughing because that
moment. Right, Betty Davis of all people.
Like, Betty Davis has that really long speech where she's like, "No, you should go. You should go." Where I have, like, that's her, like, her. And I'm telling you, you are going. Where it's like, like, she was, like, saying for, like, it seemed like she was talking for, like, 2 minutes. Where it's like, yes, you should go, and you will come back. It's like, okay, we get it. He's going. He's brave. Can we get out of this scene?
Betty Davis, faithful, meek, self-sacrificing wife. Like, I don't.
Yeah, I was
acting.
When we decided to watch these movies, I was like, oh, really excited, because I was like, oh, a Betty Davis movie, an Ingrid Bergman movie, and, you know, it's like, it seemed very exciting, and then
a Vincent Price movie.
Yeah. And then both of them Betty Davis and Ingrid Bergman are obviously two of the greatest movie stars of all time, and both of these performances were not emblematic of their careers at all.
Like no.
Betty Davis, I think this is the first time I've seen her where I was bored by her.
The only men on Earth worth their time on Earth are the men who will fight for other men.
Unlike you, I am not a gambler. I do not take any chances. Every village, every town, every mud hut in the world, there is always a man who loves children and who will fight to make a good world for them. Men who wish to live have the best chance to live. I wish to live. I wish to live with you.
Come back for me, darling. If you can.
Yeah, it's a supporting performance. And it's supposed to be a supporting performance, but they sold it as Betty Davis makes this movie. I think I read somewhere that she was really unhappy about that they sold it as she was this lead, and it was supposed to show her as an actress. And watching it, I was just like, it's the domestic movie. You know, you need to have one movie during this time that shows the home front. And why not pick a movie about a bunch of upwardly mobile people and how they deal with the war?
I did find it interesting that the, you know, because the American home front, obviously the war other than Pearl Harbor did not come to America. Mm-hmm. So I did find it interesting that it was still kind of damning about, you know, complicity and all these ways that you can be doing wrong even if you're not directly involved.
Yeah, if you look at the context of, like, Homefront movies at this time, I think the one that most people always hold up as the prime example is, like, Mrs. Miniver, which right. came out 2 years before. And that movie, spoiler alert, has a scene where a Nazi literally falls into their backyard.
Yeah.
And they have to figure out how to deal with this. You know, the war literally comes to their house. And yeah. and America not having that has to look at a lot of weird intangibles, you yeah. know. And this movie, I thought, was fascinating in how it both wants to be a Hollywood movie. So, you know, the Romanian count is the guy that's going to undo everything.
Yeah.
So it feels very hokey at times and very sentimental, but then also wants to have, like, this really, like, incisive discussion about complicity.
Yeah. I hadn't seen this movie before, and I thought Paul Lucas, is that his name?
Yeah.
I thought he was terrific in mm-hmm. a really message role, but it had all these weird, like, not guilt per se, but, like, about how compromised your soul has to become sometimes in war, even if you're doing right. Like, his, like, discomfort with his own violence was interesting to me. Like, I actually thought the movie was really interesting, even though in some ways it was filmed and shot just like a really boring message movie.
Yeah, and I agree with you about his performance. I did, like, there were moments where the writing of that character was really frustrating, though. Where I just wanted him to break free of that sort of moralizing about, you know, the importance of, like, having this valor during war and having these principles. Like, when his oldest son volunteers to go over with him, he's like, he says all this stuff about why he shouldn't go, and, like, none of the reasons he gives are, "You're my son, I love you, I don't want you to die." Like, that would have...
Yeah. Like, that would've... You can't go now, but you can go later.
Exactly.
Like, humanity could really break free.
It's like, this is your eldest child, and, like, none of that breaks through. Anyways, maybe I'm projecting my own daddy issues, but it was really bizarre to me. And, like, I think that speaks to the way that the movie is overall. Like, it's based on a Lillian Hellman play, right? And it very much feels like it's based on a play. Like, I sort of had to get used to the tenor and the rhythm of the dialogue in the beginning, especially with the children,
yeah.
who... I'm like, it's going to be revealed that they're all deep state agents of some kind, or they're, like, Martians.
On-track androids or something.
Exactly.
Yeah, because the child acting was not stellar in that particular movie.
Nope, not Margaret O'Brien caliber of acting right there.
No.
That's not my child star.
No juvenile Oscars for that movie.
No.
Oh, boy, there were so many...
Oh, sorry.
There were so many jokes about how ugly that poor little boy was, and I'm like, oh, that's...
Giving this boy a complex.
That's a Lillian Hellman in it right there.
Where she's like, you look like no one.
Two of the movies had discussions about ugliness. Strange.
And this is the second movie where I'm like, the wrong person got nominated for Best Supporting Actress. Like, I think I was just like, I'm going to watch the movie, and I didn't want to be preconditioned, so I didn't actually know which one of them was nominated before I saw the movie, because I intentionally just kind of skimmed that, and I could have sworn that it was the wife of the Romanian count who found herself in this
Geraldine Fitzgerald, yeah.
Geraldine Fitzgerald.
Yeah.
I don't understand.
Yeah, she did have a more, not more, and also a typical Oscar-type role.
Yeah, but it was more complex. I mean, Lucille Watson was like, I'm the mother. I just insist of
it. It's a grand dame type of role.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that, if anything, it's one of those where I think it was possibly, like, a Lifetime type yeah. of thing. Like, people had known her for other things. Yeah, she played Aunt March later on in Little Women in 49. And so, you know, she had crafted this body of work at an older age. She also did stage work, if memory serves. I could be completely wrong on that. But
I believe so, yeah. But, I mean, it was her 17th film, so she'd been... And she was fourth bill. I mean, it is a very large role, so...
Yeah, so I think they were like, we need an example of what we know usually about supporting actors now. I think more than anything is it's either the ingenue or the older woman that's paid her dues. And so I think that she's the older woman that's paid her dues. She's playing this matriarch of the home front, this grand dame type of figure. So, you know, it just makes sense. Again, this year, the nominations feel especially political.
Yeah. It's like, we'll give her the nomination. We know we're not going to give her the win. Right. But it's like Peter O'Toole in Venus. Like, we got to nominate him.
Yeah.
Even almost, though he was great in Venus. But you know what I mean.
In the early moments of Watch on the Rhine, it's almost like the nomination is being prescribed in the text of the film, where her son has that line where he's like, it's one of Mama's screaming days.
Right.
That's what I hope my future kids say about me one day.
Did she play the role on Broadway? I thought she had originated the role. And then
I think so, yeah. That's where I think I got the stage thing.
Yeah, that would make a lot of sense. Have momentum for...
I think Lucas had also done the stage play as well.
Mm-hmm. So, Song of Bernadette, we should probably go there.
I love this movie, and I don't care what anybody else thinks. It's a great, great movie.
It's the name Subaru is still stuck in my head. People say it 15,000 times, and it rolls off the tongue so nicely.
You can get pretty drunk in the first, like, 20 minutes.
Well, the way they say Bernadette is, like, really, it's, like, has an extra vowel in it somewhere.
Bernadette.
And it reminded me of the way they said Kurt in Watch on the Rhine. This is, like, so affected.
It's an affected movie. God bless it.
Yeah. It's one of those movies where you really have to buy into the old Hollywood aesthetic more than anything to believe that Jennifer Jones is playing a French girl.
Yeah. The accents and registers are all over the place.
Yeah.
And, like, at some point someone says, you've got Bastien your Belfry. And I was like, this doesn't sound like a translation from French. I'm very confused about where people are from.
But then Vincent Price shows up, so, like, I mean, obviously this is not his typical movie, but when he shows up, it's like, it turns a switch in my brain to accept a certain level of over-the-top unrealistic drama.
Well, see, By 1944, that was a typical Vincent Price role. I think most people get confused by, they assume that he always did horror. Right, and so I was like, no, you need to go back and watch Vincent Price in, like, the 40s when he was making, like, heavy, heavy costume dramas. Like, watch this in Dragonwyck, and you will have just the most bizarre costumey Vincent Price role ever. And he's meant to be, like, the embodiment of Satan in this film. You know, he's the atheist.
I loved him in this movie, actually.
This is one of those movies I tell people all the time, like, the religious movie, quote-unquote, is a totally different thing now in 2018 than it was in the 1940s. Because movies in the 40s could talk about God as, like, an entity. But they weren't preaching a belief system. Like, they weren't saying, like, if you don't believe in this, then you're going to go to hell and everybody's going to hate you. Whereas watching this... So I use this as a great example because it's a movie where they pretty much say in the beginning with the opening crawl, like, if you believe in this, great. If you don't, then you're going to think this is bullshit. And that's fine. I like that about the movie.
That felt like a cop-out to me. And I have a lot of problems with this movie as a lapsed Catholic. But not even just as a lapsed Catholic. I have a lot of problems with the fact that this movie has that crawl at the beginning. But the movie is definitely taking the stance that Saint Bernadette saw something.
Oh, yeah.
Saw someone, and, like, that she saw a vision of the Virgin Mary, and she didn't. Like, that's not, that didn't happen. And it's so bizarre to me that the movie's trying to have it both ways, right? Where it's like they're being really, really clear to make sure that she is not saying that she saw the Virgin Mary. And I know that they're trying to tell a story that maybe sort of happened. Mm-hmm. But it seems like it has both feet in, like, the, oh, you know, if you want to believe this, you can. If you don't want to believe it, you don't have to. Mm-hmm. And I think a movie like, this is a weird comparison, but I think a movie like Life of Pi does that actually really well. Yeah. And I know, Nathaniel, you don't like that movie, but I think that Life of Pi sort of balances the, like, you know, was it, you know, was it like divine intervention that saved him, or was it his own will? You decide. But I think with the Song of Bernadette, it just felt so... It felt really ambiguous in a way that didn't serve the film well, where, like, they were clearly taking a stance, but they didn't want to admit that they were taking a stance. And also, it's just so long and repetitive, and it goes back and forth between, like, okay, you know, but I can't do this. I can't. I have to go see her for 11 days. And it takes place over 11 days
or something. Right? I thought it was months. Like, it dragged on for so long. It dragged on. I've seen her, like, five times.
It really felt structured like a miniseries, to tell you the truth.
Yeah.
Like, if they made it today, not that they would, but if they made it today, it would be like an 8-hour HBO series or something.
And, like, before this, my main frame of reference for Jennifer Jones before this was Love is a Many Splendored Thing, because I had a professor who was obsessed with that movie, and she plays a half-Asian woman, and she says the word Eurasian, like, 17 times in that movie.
Yeah.
And I found that performance insufferable, and I kind of found her similarly, like, I get why she won Best Actress for this, but I don't think that she's for me. I think that she's a little bit, she's a little bit flat and winsome in this, in a way that is kind of prescribed by the character, but also she's those things beyond what the character needs, I think.
I think had she sold a little bit more of the fanaticism of it, in terms of, you can still, like, she's obviously taking the stance in her interpretation that Bernadette was completely pure and saw these things. So, but you could still take that to an interesting place, which she didn't.
The character is alone.
The character is so just pure and borderline naive. It made me think of Lily with Leslie Caron, where Leslie Caron plays, like, an adult woman who goes to a circus and sees a puppet show and doesn't realize that thinks the puppets are real. And it's supposed to be cute, but then you're like, there's something wrong with this woman. Like, what's going on? And it's not quite to that extent in the Song of Bernadette, but it reads very kind of, it just rings false. You want to have this young woman character who is so sweet and so innocent, and so you want her to be protected, but she has no, she's just too one note.
Although
there's something wrong with this person. There's no self doubt. There's nothing.
I did think the scene where she dug up her own spring almost went to where I wanted the performance to go.
Like, literally eating dirt. I would have liked to have seen more of that sort of weird.
Yeah, because it just seemed like it was taking her sort of complete, you know, devotion to whatever was happening to, like, an extreme place, which is one of the only times that the movie had, like, sort of disparate reactions to what was happening.
Mm-hmm. Which I'm the lone Jennifer Jones stan, I guess. I'm the lone Jennifer Jones stan. I love her.
I think she was great in Since You Went Away.
She's great in that. She's great in certain movies, and I think the reason why I stomped so much for her is because, like, if you research her life, it was horrible.
Oh yeah, Selznick, who was basically
Selznick. Selznick ruined her. And I know there's a lot of people that say she only won that Academy Award because of Selznick, which could have been very well been true. But I think I like her guile in this movie. I like her wide-eyed, you know, winsomeness. When she first sees Linda Darnell as the Virgin Mary, which seems ironic in that very sentence, you buy her wide-eyed innocence, that she's this, I think she's that child woman inspiration that Leslie Caron kind of became in later years. I think Jennifer Jones is the 40s version of, like, what Mary Pickford was for a long time in The Silence.
Yeah, totally.
So we love the child woman, you know. We love the woman who's just got this wide-eyed innocence to her. And I don't know, I buy it. I think I like the domestic angle of the movie more than I like when she's in the convent. Mostly because I think Anne Revere is my MVP for winner that year. But I don't know. I always stump for JJ because I think he gets maligned.
I like this performance a lot too, because it's not striving towards, you know, sainthood, or she doesn't have these aspirations to become a nun. This just happened to her, and I kind of like that. The first scene where she has the sighting, it's almost cute the way she just sits down and sort of takes that image in, and I like that she wasn't playing it as a big moment. So I guess, like, over a 2.5 hour long film, I mean, almost three, that maybe kind of runs up its goodwill, but I kind of like that she was kind of in a moment, the right place at the right time, and was kind of going along with it.
It could have been worse, too. Ingrid Bergman could have won For Whom the Bell Tolls.
Mm.
Oh, gosh.
Not that Ingrid Bergman isn't a better actor than Jennifer Jones, but you're also supposed to base it on that year's performances.
So magnificently did Jennifer Jones interpret the part of Bernadette, the peasant girl in Franz Werfel's The Song of Bernadette, that from the moment this great motion picture was first publicly presented, there was no doubt that it had given the world a new, incomparable star. By special arrangement, this theater is permitted to show you briefly something of the magnitude, the beauty, the sweep and power of this distinguished and great production. Neither from this screen nor from the screen of any other theater have you seen an entertainment destined to linger so vividly in your memory as an unforgettable experience.
So the Song of Bernadette supporting ladies were actually, it seemed to be the performances that we were most divided on.
Mm-hmm.
People were kind of all over the place about both of them. So we should say something about those.
Well, if we were talking about kind of like the politics of it, if the Watch on the Rhine nomination was for like the Grand Dame, then Gladys Cooper was like that one good monologue.
Yeah.
I'm fine with it. It is what it is. It's a good monologue.
Yeah.
Gladys Cooper, who will always be the old lady from that one episode of The Twilight Zone for me. Yeah, she's good. She's good. But yeah, she is supposed to be the ultimate legitimizer, I think, of the movie, which is that if we can convince this nun that she's seen something, that she's definitely seen something. And yeah, once the movie introduces her in a movie that already feels very lengthy, I think that the people who were nominating that year were just like, thank God, the movie's almost over. We got it on. We'll nominate her if we just end it. And for me, I think Anne Revere is the MVP. I rated her the highest on my list just because I think she's fantastic. She was another one that had a very lengthy career in film, and she's so good as Bernadette's mom. You know, she conveys the struggles of not just having a daughter who is, you know, seeing weird stuff, but the fact that they're poor, you know, and the fact that she's not able to do enough for her children. And, you know, when she thinks that there's a scene where she thinks Bernadette is ill and she like drops everything and races to the house to go see her. I mean, you really feel for this gamut of emotions this woman runs through. It's a very subtle performance. It's not showy. It's not flamboyant in any way, shape or form. And I think those are the performances that often get, you know, forgotten just because there's really nothing to grab onto.
Well, I agree with all that about her, but my issue with the performance was really that it had nowhere to go after that. Like, she's, in the first 15 minutes, I found her very effective. And then I was just like, why is the character still in the movie if they're not going to give her anything to do? Which is the opposite of Gladys Cooper. For the first half of the movie, I was like, why did she get nominated? Was it for those two scenes at the beginning where she basically calls Bernadette stupid? I didn't, because I thought, no, there's no way we could have another act of the movie after all this. But then so there suddenly we were at the nunnery.
Yeah, I'm surprised Anne Revere didn't win. I gave her and Anne Goddard and Watson all three stars, but I think I would have voted for Anne Revere. I think that I found it really, like what Kristen was saying about the range of emotions, and then after she thinks that Bernadette is ill, she switches to being frustrated because she burned dinner. Like, she left dinner on the stove to go. And like, you know, and that may seem like a silly thing, but if you're poor and you burn dinner, like that's, you know, that's your food. And I can understand why she's like so harried. And also there's that great moment where she's trying to like comfort Bernadette when she's crying at night, where she's like, oh, like, come, she's like, come talk to your mother. And I think that it's more so in the beginning, because I do agree with Nathaniel that she sort of settles into the same register for the rest of the movie, where she's just kind of playing it at the same pitch. Mm-hmm. But I think that there's more of a range in the beginning that sold me on the performance early on, and I think she's acting. I think that her acting is really good. I'm not so convinced about Gladys Cooper, but I get why both of them were nominated. It's like Gladys Cooper, even without the sort of reversal at the end, if you even want to call it that. I think that like sort of mean characters like that, and especially like an imperious nun, I think that's definitely something that is easy to latch onto. And she's Gladys Cooper, you know, she's not new to them, and she was popular, so it made sense.
Yeah. So I do have a question about the plot of Song of Bernadette's Death. Where am I to believe that the entire time she had this incredible pain and that we just didn't see it? Or is that something that happened as soon as she got to the convent? Like, was the idea that they were trying to express there that she just hasn't been complaining about all this physical pain she was in? Or was that a new affliction when she arrived at the convent?
It's weird that this is such a long movie and they wouldn't clarify.
Well, based on my Wikipedia research about the real Bernadette, it did seem like something that came later on in life where, you know, she had these symptoms that emerged and then she had this diagnosis. So I sort of felt like it was something that came up toward the end of her life and not something she was sublimating or trying to repress.
Yeah, that's what I took it as, is like it popped up after she'd already been brought into the convent because it was essentially like the final stage to sainthood.
Yeah, that was a very fast-moving illness.
As they all are in film. He died.
Yeah, that's true. You cough once, then you're dead.
Blooded a handkerchief.
Okay, so we have to play my favorite game with the SmackDown. Move the actresses around and put them in other roles. Like, who would you want to see play who else's role? If you had to recast between these five actresses.
Mm.
So, Yassine, let's start with you.
Oh, gosh, I wanted to go last. I don't know, like something just popped up in my head, Godard, in the Gladys Cooper role. I don't know why that came to me, and especially since the Gladys Cooper role is meant to be this nun who's been practicing for years and years, but I think just Godard's facial wizardry, I think I call it in my blurb, yeah. Like she's so expressive, and it'd be interesting to put her in a role that makes her kind of have to control that and just show disapproval until the very last minute switcheroo. So that's just what popped into my head.
Oh, I like that, though, because Godard, as I said in my write-up, she's very physically expressive as an actor. And the thing that held me back from loving Gladys Cooper's performance, even though I loved her last couple scenes, was that she... Like, I get that it's a nun, but you can't do anything with your body other than just stand. Like, she never moved at all in any of her scenes. So I like that answer. How about you, Rebecca?
You know, I'm going to put Katina Paxinou as the nun because I want to see a crazy ranting nun for no deeper reason than that. Just I want it to be the same character. I just want her to be a nun in this different movie because it would be insane.
I think that's what Melissa Leo was doing in Novitiate, right?
Yes. Sure. That's what I want. More crazy nuns in movies.
How about you, Krista?
I was going to say the Paulette Goddard role, or Paulette Goddard in the Katina role in For Whom the Bell Tolls, mostly because Paulette's played brownface before in several of her movies, so it wouldn't be a stretch for her. But I also think it would be very intriguing to see how a character that is kind of meant to be the ball and chain of the movie... In For Whom the Bell Tolls, who becomes this kind of freedom fighter, I think it would be interesting, but it would also be very Paulette. Because, again, I think she's played roles like that. If you've seen, like, Reap the Wild Wind or, like, the Royal Mounted Police movie she made, where she plays, like, a Native American. So, yeah, it would make sense.
And Kira?
I was thinking about who I would want to see in the Paulette Goddard role. Especially since, like, she's the youngest of all these actresses. And I was thinking about Katina Paxinou in that role and how that would give the role sort of a different tenor, obviously. But I was actually thinking about Anne Revere in that role because Anne Revere for most of her career, she was sort of like motherly and matronly, mm-hmm. and didn't really get to be anything. She didn't really get to travel so much outside of that wheelhouse, so I would have been interested in seeing that. And it wouldn't have been such a stretch, because she's not... Anne Revere is basically the same age as Claudette Colbert, and I know that Claudette Colbert is supposed to be older than the rest of the women, but... Yeah. I don't know. I would have been fascinated to see what she would have done with a role like that, and how, like, maybe, you know, she's a veteran nurse too, and they change it up a bit, but, you know, something where she gets to be more than like someone's mother leaning in doorways watching her children, you know?
Mm-hmm. I can totally see that, because, like, yeah, Anne Revere did seem to be cast in very limited ways.
She won for National Velvet, right?
Yeah.
And
she's, like, obviously such a talented actor. So I wonder, in the studio system, outside of the studio system, had she been, like, 10 years later, what kind of roles she might have gotten.
Yeah, definitely.
I would want to... So I really like all those answers, and I think that I would want to switch Lucille Watson and Gladys Cooper. Because... Oh. I think the problem with the nun in Song of Bernadette is that there's no range at all to the performance except for in that final monologue. So if I could have a little Lucille Watson sort of unself-aware comedy earlier on in the sort of bitchy nun, and if I could have Gladys Cooper's sort of like gravitas and power in Lucille Watson's final arc with the realizing her complicity, I think that would have made both movies richer. So that's my answer. And so before we go, 1943, we only had to watch these four movies, but other than Casablanca, which we discussed our favorite lines from earlier, what movies do you really cherish from this year that you hope people will watch if they haven't seen?
Ooh, I could throw out a couple. I'd say The Oxbow Incident. If anybody wants a highly politically charged movie about what was going on in 1943, actually, The Oxbow Incident is timely for any time period. You should really watch that. It's a great movie. The More the Merrier is a great one. I'm a fan of, like, the 40s housing crisis films that they came out with. And also, always time for some Val Lewton, so I Walked with a Zombie, or Seventh Victim is fine, but I prefer I Walked with a Zombie, which is also good. And Stage Door Canteen, if you want to watch the weird canteen films they came out with, in the mid-40s, where it was just an excuse to get everybody from the studio to perform, weird cameos and everything, Yeah, it's really, really good. They made several of them. So, really, if you watch one, you've seen that studio. But, yeah, those are worth watching.
Mm-hmm. I started watching The Seventh Victim, actually, this week. I downloaded it, and I only got halfway through, and I'm like, does it get more interesting? Because so far, does it just wait till the end to become this? Because I kept hearing it was amazing.
It's good. It's very weird. I think if audiences who grew up on, like, most horror films today watched it, they would be like, what the hell is this? It's a very genteel look at a certain subsection of horror, and I won't spoil it. So yeah, you're gonna get to what it all means, and you're gonna be like, okay, so this is what they based Rosemary's Baby off of if Rosemary's Baby was just really, really polite.
Okay. All right. So I will finish watching it.
It's worth watching.
Okay. How about you, Rebecca?
I second the Val Lewton. I think it was Leopard Man 43?
I thought it was... I think it's 44.
Well, I'm looking... let me IMDb. It says 43 on IMDb, which release date, I don't know, but Leopard Man's great. Mm-hmm. Heaven Can Wait is one that I think Jane Tierney should have been in the conversation here. Mm-hmm. I guess you could put her up for supporting or lead actress. I don't know. Category fraud's rampant. They can do what they want, but I would put Jean Tierney above most of the people who actually got nominated.
Yeah.
So that's my two.
How about you, Yassine?
I think the Claude Rains Phantom of the Opera will always have.
Oh, right. You mentioned that in your intro.
Yeah, just because I saw the stage musical Phantom of the Opera 13 times in my teens. That's probably another podcast of what was going on there. But when I was obsessed with that, I would like loan out every copy of the Phantom of the Opera, like every film adaptation that had existed. And I think that one is the most kind of colorful and the one that is imprinted in my memory more than the other one. So. And the Casablanca alumni.
Right. And Kieran?
Well, I mentioned Shadow of a Doubt in the sort of introducing the panelists post that you did. And, you know, it's ridiculous Teresa Wright wasn't nominated, especially given that lineup and who ended up winning. But I love Cabin in the Sky. I don't necessarily think it's a great movie, but it just, I love it. I love the music in it. And I also love, like, I think the history behind the release of that movie is so fascinating.
Totally. Yeah, I forget. I watched it once a few years ago for, like, a thing that I didn't end up doing, which was going to be, like, Musical of the Month. And it is really, like, when I was researching it, I was like, wow, this movie had quite a run in an interesting way.
Mm-hmm.
And plus, it's Vincent Minnelli.
Yeah. Yep.
Who is a great director.
Yeah, and I don't feel like Cabin in the Sky gets brought up a lot when people are talking about Minnelli musicals, which I understand why, but it's just, I think if you haven't seen it, you should definitely watch it, especially if you love musicals.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And obviously any, like, comedies from the 30s and 40s are amazing. So anything that says comedy by it on IMDb from that time period, you should watch. Including The More the Merrier, which was nominated for some Oscars that year, actually quite a few, which Kristen, you already mentioned, More the Merrier.
Yeah, it's a really, really good movie, and I'm surprised that more people don't know about it. It's got Jean Arthur, who I think is an unsung gem, and it's got one of the sexiest moments in movies at that time. There's a scene between her and Joel McRae on a stoop. It's really, really great. And yeah, if you like weird if you like Preston Sturges-esque comedy where it's just like comedy of errors, and a delightful old man who's mean to you, but it's just because he's really, really lonely.
You know what's so interesting to me is that George Stevens directed it. And
yeah.
I always think of him as such like I like his movies a lot. Like A Place in the Sun is one of my all-time favorites, but and, of course, Giant is great, but I always think of him as such a heavy director.
Yeah, and he did go, I mean, he served in World War II, if anybody's read Five Came Back, watched the documentary. Mm-hmm. And he's done so many different movies. I mean, he did Shane and Diary of Anne Frank and this movie, Woman of the Year, Penny Serenade. I mean, he's made so many different movies, and they're all good. They're all good.
Yeah. Super talented. Well, thank you guys so much for discussing 1943 for us. So it was really, I was going to say it was really exciting, but it wasn't exciting to watch the movies, but it was exciting to talk about them afterwards.
Yeah, it was.
Which is why I always think that anybody listening should actually watch all the movies we're covering in a given month, because it, even if you don't love them, like for whom the Bell Tolls, for example, which was a chore to get through, you still get so much more fascinating context the more movies you see from any particular year. So I highly recommend any Oscar category looking up one particular year. I just think you'll always glean something from it that you weren't expecting.
And if you're going to do 1943, do not do what I did and accidentally write the wrong deadline down. So I thought I only had 3 days to watch everything. So I had to, like, shotgun them all back to back to back. Which was a lesson in strength.
If you're going to do For Whom the Bell Tolls, do it like a 1.5 speed. And
exactly, yes.
Chipmunk point speed.
What order did you watch them in, Kristen? I'm curious.
I did Song of Bernadette last because I have a Blu-ray copy. So I went, I started with For Whom the Bell Tolls first. And then I think
that's
I went
smart to get it out of the way first.
Exactly. Well, and I had never seen it, and it was hard to nail down. So I was like, okay, I should probably watch this one. Watch on the Rhine is on Filmstruck, so I watched that second to last. And then So Proudly We Hail, I know of a where a copy can be obtained, but it was difficult. So at least two of these movies were not easy for me to get on short notice. But turns out I didn't have short notice. I just wrote the date wrong.
This is where I sound like a stupid person. Did anyone, when they were watching For Whom the Bell Tolls in the beginning, because I rented it off Amazon, and I'm like, is there something wrong with the picture in the beginning? Because it had this long, and I get that movies had like long overtures back then, and my roommate was like, yeah, that's the overture. That's you're fine. There's nothing wrong.
Oh, it happened on iTunes as well. It's just like a pitch black screen.
Yeah, exactly.
For so long, screen. And I was like, something's wrong with my copy.
Exactly.
Because sometimes with overtures, they'll at least have, like, a title card up.
Right, yeah. Right, exactly. And then the pictures came up, and it's like, maybe a black screen would have been better.
It's so funny. I know when I went to the movies, I think, to see Funny Girl, I think. And I've seen Funny Girl numerous times, but they actually had to have an employee come in and tell people, there will be an overture. And there will be an intermission. There is nothing wrong with the screen. It's just how they did it. And I was like, do you really have to explain that to people?
Yeah, I think you do, unfortunately.
Apparently, yeah, it made me feel old, apparently. Well, or maybe smarter, because I knew my classic film.
No, you guys remember
good.
That
I mean,
whole thing.
Classic film newbies are getting into it, and they're dipping their toes in.
I remember that whole a controversy because I'm super old now. I remember that whole, like, you had to explain Letterboxd to people. What's wrong with my screen? Because everything would be, like, the black bars on the top.
And now I continually complain about how Letterboxd is in our movie theaters now, and it sucks.
All right. Thank you, everyone. Once again, the panelists, Rebecca Polly.
Yes.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Kristen Lopez.
It was so awesome. And I forgot, Rebecca and I follow each other on Twitter, and we talk all the time. So I actually get to see her face-to-face. So, yay.
And you look a lot like Marjorie Terrell.
I know. I'm not showing. Yeah. I'm catfishing as Natalie Dormer. So. Oh.
That's why good I point. Couldn't find you on Skype, Kristen. I was I know what you look like. And I was like, none of these people I recognize.
I keep saying I've been saying I'm going to change that photo for about 5 years. I haven't done it yet.
And Kieran Scarlett?
Bye, this was a lot of fun. I want to describe myself like Veronica Lake. Can you believe how Veronica Lake is described in the trailer for the movie where they're like, can you believe a woman so beautiful is so cold?
She's more than cold, trust me.
And Yasin Ali.
Thank you. I'm sitting here like Lucille Watson, furrowing my brow, thinking.
You were complicit in allowing this podcast to happen.
I'll have to live with that for the rest of my life.